So thank you so much. It's as always my pleasure to speak. So I'm gonna. Are there some stick or something? Oh, there is. Yeah. No, over here. It's not. Yeah. Good. Thank you. I like this one. Right, so I'm going to talk about dynamical fixed points, and so this is based on a couple of papers. So I will be fairly pedagogical, so the subject can get quite technical pretty fast, and so I just want to convey the idea. Please feel free to interrupt me at any time and ask questions. So as you know, holography has been very useful to study strongly interacting systems. And so it's fair to say that there has been many original discoveries that were inspired or found using a holography. A lot of them has been later understood just from pure field theory perspective, but it's undeniable that holography played a role. So some examples is the idea that you can think about relativistic hydrodynamics as an effective field theory. So it's the way how to compute the equation of state of some strongly coupled gauge series. The famous computation of transport coefficients. The idea of quantum quenches, so what happens with your quantum field theory far from equilibrium. The whole study of the concept of the entropy current, the ideas of thermalization, isotropization, and so on. So the list goes for a very long time, and I just picked up something that, it's a very personal pick. But so what I would like to talk today is something that I call dynamical fixed points. And so I want to say that, so again, here in this case, it was almost found accidentally, and I still don't have the pure field theoretical understanding what's going on. Okay, so here's an outline of the talk. So what I'm going to do, I am going to briefly review the hydrodynamics, and I want to convince that you can think about gauge series in de Sitter spacetime from the hydrodynamic perspective. And so in particular, I will focus on, so if you do think in these terms, then your de Sitter hydrodynamics will necessarily break down. And it's important to understand that breaking down so that you can answer this question. So where was this dynamical fixed point hiding? And then what I will go through in quite details, I would go through like a trivial dynamical fixed point, which from the definition later on, you will see that it's not a dynamical fixed point, but it sets up the computation at the level that pretty much any undergraduate can take and do the computations and do the studies in the holography. So what I will do, I will study something that can be done completely analytically, and so the tools will be clear. So we will study thermal states of n equal 4 supersymmetric Young mills in de Sitter. We will do the gauge theory perspective, the holographic picture, and then this is something that is just the name. I use it as entanglement entropy, but you can call it whatever you want. We can discuss this. And so once I cover this, then I will explain to you where the non-trivial dynamical fixed points come about. I will focus on a particular model. So this is a model where a lot of computations has been done on my end, has been done by Costa Skenderis, which reproduced many of the results that I will talk about. However, I want to say that this thing has been extended to top-down holographic models. It's much more technical, and if you're interested, I can point you out to some literature. And so the very interesting thing that there is, if you wish, there is a specific application of the whole this idea, and this gives I would say, a new perspective on the gravitational reheating, which could be relevant at strong coupling. Good. So as I said, you can interrupt me at any time. So let's recall thermal equilibrium, right? So So we used to think that thermal equilibrium is a late time attractor of dynamical evolution. So what I mean by that, if I look at stress energy tensor and I ask what it looks like at late times, so it takes this particular diagonal form, and so the steamy new you know, are components of the stress energy tensor at time t and spatial location x. So that's thermal equilibrium, and what we have, we also have a theory that describes how do we approach the thermal equilibrium. That's a universal theory, and this is known as a hydrodynamics. And so the idea of this approach is that what you think of, stress energy tensor as a derivative expansion, like we think about effective field theories. So we organize the expansion of the stress energy tensor in the gradients of the velocity, temperature, and what we have. And then basically we have the equation of motion, which is a conservation of the stress energy tensor. So let me highlight for you the couple terms in this effective theory of relativistic hydrodynamics. So as I said, it's an expansion in the gradients of the velocity. So u mu is a local fluid velocity. So here I am considering in general curved background spacetime. And so here you have a term which you can think of is your thermal equilibrium. So this is a contribution to the stress energy tensor without any gradients. So the term involving the first derivatives of the velocity, it involves transport coefficients. If your fluid is uncharged, those are just your shear and bulk viscosities. And then you can continue on. And so the holography, again, has been very useful in developing this program. So it's important to understand what is the validity of the hydrodynamics as an effective theory. And the idea is that so at late times, you have to approach thermal equilibrium. And so this thermal equilibrium is characterized by a scale, which is temperature. And so it's natural to measure all gradients with respect to this scale. And so your hydrodynamics is valid when all the gradients are small. Good, so what else do we do when we talk about approach towards equilibrium? What we can do, we can construct the so-called entropy current. And again, this beast has derivative expansion. So from the conservation of the stress energy tensor, this was taken as a, if you wish, as a guiding principle. How do we construct the entropy current? Because strictly speaking, the concept of entropy is an equilibrium concept, and so an entropy current is something that you need to explain. How do you define it for non-equilibrium systems? And so one way that has been guiding people in constructing these derivative expansions is the concept that that whatever happens with your dynamics, the entropy can only increase, okay? And so I wrote this statement over here. So this simply comes, given the derivative expansion and you impose the conservation of the stress energy tensor. So in a normal materials, the viscosities are positive, and so you can see clearly that for all fluid flow, the entropy is being produced. Okay, so that's hydrodynamics. And so now if you wait long enough, then the flow will stop, right? So you approach the equilibrium. So all the gradients will go to zero. And so in particular, what will happen is that the entropy current will vanish. And that's actually a signature that you reached equilibrium. You stopped producing the entropy. Right, so now I'm just defining for you what's the dynamical fixed point. So it's exactly the same, except for one condition. So you do not stop producing the entropy. So the entropy production continues to go ahead even at infinitely long time. So it's something that's non-zero. And in particular, it's that's why you would say that it's a dynamical thing, because the dynamics is ongoing. You keep producing the entropy even in the limit of asymptotically late times. So I want to say that, so this, you would say this is the only difference from sort of thermal equilibrium, right? So in thermal equilibrium, you have just some constant expectation values of stress energy tensor, like whatever one-point correlation functions of some gauge invariant operators. I'm saying that the same thing will be here. So in the simplest models, those valves will be constant. And the only thing that's going to happen that you're going to keep producing the entropy. So you say, well, it's crazy, right? So anybody can come up with, you know, this just nonsensical statement. So what's the purpose of this? Of course, it has not been done this way. I'm just presenting it this interesting way. But in reality, it comes the other way around, right? So it happened that whatever I am talking about turns out to be relevant if you study gauge theories in cosmological backgrounds, and in particular in asymptotically dissiter space-time. And so from this perspective, you know, like one of the things in condensed matter, you know, I want to classify all phases of matter. So here the program is I want to classify all dynamical fixed points, okay? And so much like in condensed matter, so when you talk about different phases, there can be phase transitions. You can ask the question, is this phase perturbatively, non-perturbatively stable? And so all of this is translated here. So all these questions, and if you're interested, I cannot talk about all of these things in one talk, but a lot of these things can be studied in the concept of this dynamical fixed points. So are there any questions so far? No? Good. So let's...
I have a question, actually. Can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Can you just... Something fundamental about the whole setup. You said the one-point function of the stress tensor should be homogeneous in space and time. In a curved space-time, could you clarify exactly what that assumption means? Because I'm thinking about like a de Sitter space, which is not going to have a global, you know, translation symmetry group that remains time-like, or it just, yeah, what's the assumption exactly?
So why don't we talk at the end, because I will be showing you explicit examples. So of course, you know, there are different complicated phases of matter which are not homogeneous and isotropic, like striped phases in condensed matter and so on. And so what we will be discussing the simplest dynamical fixed points that are characterized by spatial isotropy and spatial translational invariance. So that's what I mean. It doesn't mean that there are no more complicated dynamical fixed points. This is not what I studied. Okay, so very good. So I'm showing you this non-trivial example so that you would believe me that de Sitter dynamics is a hydrodynamics. Okay, that's the only purpose of the numbers I'm showing you. So there is one non-conformal example of top-down holography that has been studied. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Those of you who know will know. If not, it's not going to be very helpful. The so-called n equal 2 star quark-gluon plasma. So it's some holographic model. It's some gauge theory, four-dimensional gauge theory, that is not conformal. And so here, you can put this theory in Minkowski spacetime, and you can use holography techniques to learn quite a lot about this theory. And so in particular, you will learn its equation of state. So here you see the equation of state that's characteristic of the conformal UV fixed point. And then there are corrections because the theory is not conformal. So strictly speaking, here the theory has bosons and fermions. And what you can do, you can give separate masses to those bosons and fermions, and that's the way how, you know, you basically break explicitly scale invariance, and so the equation of state will get modified. So what you can do further, you can compute transport in this theory, and you get some 1/432 with some numbers and gamma functions and all of that. So there is a way to compute it, okay? So that's, I emphasize, that's in the Minkowski spacetime. So now what we're going to do, we're going to take this theory and we're going to put it in the expanding universe, FLRW. So I reminded you what the metric looks like. So the space is isotropic and homogeneous, and so I have a single A of T, which is a scale factor. So I'm not going to restrict now for any particular form. Everything that I'm going to talk about is valid for any A of T. And so what we can do in this cosmology, when we interpret it as hydrodynamics, we can go to a local or a co-moving frame. So in this case, the four velocity is constant, but because the space is curved, so the divergence of the four velocity is not constant, right? So here you can, given this metric, you can compute a divergence of the four velocity, and you will find out that it's not zero if the space-time is dynamical. So now if we go back and we ask the question, okay, so the hydrodynamics gave us specific prediction, how much is the entropy production rate? And so to leading order, it has left-hand side, that's the entropy production rate, and so it has these two terms, right? So one term is sensitive to the divergence of the four velocity, and the other one is some little bit more complicated gradients of the four velocity. So for the isotropic expansion, as we have over here, so this combination vanishes. And so the entropy production of this theory in De Sitter comes exclusively from the bulk viscosity. What we can do, we can now make a check, right? So when I take this model, I put it in a holography, you will see exactly how this computation is done. So you can compute what is the entropy production rate. Okay, so on a holographic side, it will correspond to the dynamics of the apparent horizon. And so you can independently compute this quantity. And then you have a specific prediction, right? Because I know what's A dot over A is, so I know what this is. And so I can extract what would be, if I think about De Sitter expansion as hydrodynamics, how would that hydrodynamics think about the ratio of the bulk viscosity to the entropy density? And you will reproduce exactly this horrible formula over here. So this was verified some years ago in this paper. So what I'm trying to convince you is that there is a simple way how, you know, the De Sitter expansion is nothing but a hydrodynamics in this local or co-moving frame.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So when you put a field theory in a curved space, that's there's no canonical wielding, that there's an ambiguity in doing this. So when you write it like this, what do you have in mind?
What do you mean?
I think that when you put n equals to star in whatever curved geometry,
right,
there's no unique way of doing that. For example,
You're talking about potential couplings to the background, right?
Yeah.
I'm controlling those couplings. You have to do the right thing, right?
No, but there's the right thing. You can add a alternative linear Riemann tensor, and this will change the energy momentum tensor.
Yeah, I agree with you. So that you would have right. Yeah.
So
there is, this is controllable thing that you can do. For example, if in the theory you can do a localization, then you must have coupling to the Riemann tensor, right, in order to preserve supersymmetry on S4. And so that coupling affects it, right? However, in this computation, when I'm saying that I'm reproducing the Minkowski value of the bulk viscosity, I have to set these couplings to zero. I have the control over that.
You have to, that's a choice you make.
It's a choice I make, right? So on a supergravity side, there is a very specific coupling that I know, you can identify, and it's up to you to put it to zero or not. Of course, when you are in Minkowski spacetime, it doesn't matter because that's going to be zero. In curved spacetime, that will affect your results. But I know what it is, okay? And I'm saying that if I want to match to Minkowski, you know, to Minkowski computation of bulk viscosity, I know that I need to put it, you know, to zero. Otherwise, so when I go back to this formula for the stress derivative expansion of the stress energy tensor, there will be coupling to the curvature there as well. And so that's all understood. So that dictionary is understood.
Can I just
Another question. You started out mentioning that you were going to describe a situation where the one-point function of a stress tensor was time-independent and homogeneous. But in this case, it's not time-independent. So is it not an example of what your main subject is, or what?
Well, it will be time-independent in this case as well. But this is not a late time, okay? That will be clear. That will be clear on the next transparency. Yeah, Rob.
No, I'm sorry. How can it possibly be time independent? I mean,
I'm not saying it's not time independent. It is time independent, but that is not a dynamical fixed point. So this is not a dynamical fixed. Just wait until next transparency.
Okay.
You did something where the universe is expanding, but not too fast.
Exactly.
What that means, though, not too fast.
Right. So that is exactly, you know, both of the questions are exactly that. So I just convinced you that it looks like that this theta is hydrodynamics, but so far so good. And now you can ask the question that there were both questions. So what's the validity of this d theta hydro, right? So I told you I reproduce this transport. And you remember the thing was that the gradients of the velocity has to be much smaller than the temperature. Well, what's the gradient of velocity? It's really the Hubble parameter. At late times, if you approach d theta, that's going to be the Hubble constant. And the temperature, you know, if you open undergraduate book, you know that the temperature is redshifted with the scale factor. And so what Rob is pointing out is everything I described is really early times when the, you know, when the temperature is still much larger than the gradients. And it is only in that regime I have a valid hydrodynamic description of the d theta expansion. However, that is not what I'm interested in. And so in particular, what I'm interested in is what happens with this theory at very late time. And I know that at very late time, I always violate this condition. I always violate the applicability of hydrodynamic description. And that is where we will see the dynamical fixed point comes. Okay, so just to summarize what we have, so if I have a theory in Minkowski spacetime, so I have some state, it's some non-equilibrium initial state, I allow it to evolve, it will equilibrate to a thermal equilibrium. And so now if I'm going to take this theory and I claim that if you put it in this theta spacetime and you wait long enough, you reach this dynamical fixed point. Okay. So you will see this explicitly. Now, what I have done, I put an asterisk here. And the asterisk means that whatever you do, do not do it with the CFT. Okay? And you will see it in a second why that's the case. All right? So very good. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to slow down a little bit. I want you to understand it's very simple. So we're going to discuss N equal 4 theory from both perspectives. So we're going to look at the thermal states of N equal 4 in expanding universe, both from field theory and holography. And I will show you the explicit techniques that you use to do the computations. Okay, very good. So I already told you this. And then you notice that actually FLRW is just while equivalent to Minkowski, so there is this scale factor. And because the theory is conformal, we know how observables of this theory transform under the Weyl transformations. And so in particular, if I have some primary operator of some conformal dimension, I know how it will transform. I also know how the stress energy tensor will transform, except that now it will pick up conformal or normal. So. So let's see. So what I can do, I can look at a thermal state of the theory in Minkowski spacetime. It will be characterized by the energy density and pressure. And then I can use this wild transformation, and I ask, so what would be, you know, the stress energy tensor of the theory in the expanding universe, right? And so I'm gonna get this formula. So I'm saying that this is a very standard computations and has been done years ago. Good. So so in particular, so this is what I was saying. So if we start with a thermal equilibrium state at a given temperature T, then you find the energy density and the pressure will be time dependent. And so you can kind of put it in the form that it almost looks like equilibrium. And the only thing that happens is that you have this idea that there will be a redshift of the temperature. Okay, something that we had used before. And so so in the holographic models, so the stress energy tensor is covariantly conserved automatically if you do things right. And so this conservation of the stress energy tensor gives you the familiar the familiar equation for the stress energy tensor in the expanding universe. Good. So that's as far as stress energy concern. And so now I'm going to move to the entropy. So what will happen with the entropy? So remember, in the Minkowski spacetime, we started with the equilibrium state. So this equilibrium state was characterized by set at equilibrium entropy density. And so pretty much what the all undergraduate cosmology textbooks tell you is that if you talk about the expansion of the universe, you have to think that your expansion is adiabatic. Okay, and so if we're going to make this assumption, I want to say that once we do holographic computations, we do not need to make this assumption. However, I don't know, you know, if I'm just on the field theory side, I think that you are implicitly or explicitly making this assumption. So if you say that you have an adiabatic expansion, then your co-moving entropy density is constant. And so here you will reproduce the time dependence of the entropy density with exactly the same behavior of the temperature as as you guessed from the energy density and pressure. All right, so now you can see what happens is that, so if we wait long enough, so the scale factor goes to infinity, and so the entropy density will go to zero, the physical entropy density. And so that's why some of the things you hear is that this theta is very, you know, low entropy, empty space. And so one way of thinking about this is that you see that, you know, there is a vanishing entropy density. Good. So now I want to rephrase exactly this entropy discussion in terms of the entropy current. So while the conservation of the entropy current is frame independent, so how do you define the entropy current depends on frame. And so, for example, if we go to the so-called Landau frame, then the entropy current takes this simple form. And so you can find the divergence of the entropy current is simply means that what you're computing a time derivative of the co-moving entropy, and that's zero, okay? So this is why I was saying that when we have n equal 4 or in general conformal field theory, and when we put it in expanding universe, at late times, what we get is basically Bunch-Davis's vacuum, or from my perspective, just a trivial dynamical fixed point. Okay. So, are there any questions before I go?
In this, yeah. How do you use the theta?
So how do I use this iterative? Because
we assume this iterative.
At this stage, I didn't have to assume anything about this iterative, but I have to, I have to focus on this iterative just to tell you where this non-trivial dynamical fixed point arises. Okay, so remember that in a conformal theory, the physical entropy density was going to zero. So now imagine that you have a model in which the physical entropy density does not go to zero, but in fact approaches a constant. And so now when you compute divergence of the entropy current, you will find out that in the limit of late times, it will be precisely this entropy. Okay, so what I am saying is that for these dynamical fixed points, the entropy production rate is governed by the physical entropy density at late times. And you need to have this iter, right? Because you want this thing to be non-zero as well. So you want, at very late times, to have a non-vanishing Hubble constant. Okay, so it's an interesting thing. So when I talk about this iter dynamical fixed points, it's always going to be this iter dynamical fixed points. I'm not sure if you restrict to other cosmologies, then you have to think a little bit more whether you will have that or not. Okay, and so basically the statement is that that's exactly what you will find, okay? And I will show you some of the pictures that when you do computations in non-conformal series, so in a conformal series, you know that this thing will be zero. And I claim that in a non-conformal series, that thing will not be zero. And that's going to be your dynamical fixed point.
Just so I understand this equation, I mean, on this page, you're saying I can use a general A and that equation in the middle holds.
Yes.
But you want H to be a constant.
Right, because this will be zero. Otherwise, you will not have entropy production rate. You're absolutely right. Yeah. So this is really just a divergence in that background space-time.
A general problem.
Yeah, general background. All right, very good. So I gave you the intuition from the quantum field theory perspective. So let's see what's how the sausage is made on a holography side. So now what I'm going to do, I'm going to look at n equal 4 super young Niels in expanding universe. Because we are looking at the states that are thermal in Minkowski spacetime, our model is going to be incredibly simple. I don't have to care about any other operators that I have. And so this is my effective action. So I have a negative cosmological constant. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to study states which are spatially homogeneous and isotropic. So this is my metric ansatz. So this is a familiar incoming Eddington-Finkenstein coordinates. So you plug this metric ansatz. Before you plug this metric ansatz, did I have already the equations or not? No, I did not. Well, so you need to specify boundary conditions, and you specify boundary conditions to say that your gauge theory lives in this iter spacetime. And so that implies a very particular asymptotes on these warp factors, metric warp factors, A and sigma. And so in particular here, you have A of T. And again, at this stage, I'm not restricting. A of T can be anything. And so now when you look what asymptotically my metric look like, So you can see, so I'm working in a Poincaré patch of ADS. And so you can see that my boundary metric is really the metric of the expanding FLRW universe. Good, so now you have the equations of motion, you derive the equations of motion. It's a system of coupled PDEs that you can solve explicitly. Okay, so it's very simple. So there is nothing else, just these two warp factors. So what does it depend on? R is your radial coordinate. Sorry. That's not supposed. That's my daughter. Okay, good. So it's characterized by two parameters. One is an arbitrary function, lambda of t, and so it enters in several places here. So lambda of t is, it depends on time. So you can see A is your scale factor of the expanding universe. And then there is one more constant. This constant is R naught. Okay, so it must be constant if you want to solve the equations of motion. So this parameter lambda of t is just some residual diffeomorphism invariance. You shouldn't worry about it. You can set it to whatever you want. So the only physical parameter in this solution is this constant R naught. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to say, okay, let me redefine this constant. Let me call this constant R over 2 to be equal T naught. And then I'm going to use the machinery of holography to compute the boundary stress energy tensor. When I do that, I reproduce precisely the field theory results, the ones that I mentioned. You start with a thermal state in the Minkowski spacetime, and then you're going to wild transform it into expanding universe. So this comes automatically with all the factors. Everything comes exactly as it is on the field theory side.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Does that mean that I could have done a coordinate transformation?
Yes, exactly. So that is the reason. So this wild transformation and mapping the dynamics of the CFTs in conformal, in d-theta versus in Minkowski is nothing but a coordinate transformation on the background geometry, because there are no source terms in the CFT, so it's just that. Now you know why you cannot do this when the theory is not conformal, because then your mass scales will be exponentially growing. It will, you know, just because it has dimension, so it will scale appropriately with the scale factor. So you can treat, and that's actually the approach that Kostas Skenderis was taking here. So you can think of this from the Minkowski perspective, but then you will have some singular sources and things like that. So I prefer this, which is more physical and natural. Good. But there is holography actually buys us a little bit more. So there is an apparent horizon in this geometry, and so we can identify where this apparent horizon is. And so once we do this, we can compute the co-moving entropy of this apparent horizon. So this is a standard technique that has been pioneered by Chesler and Yaffe. And so you will get some number. What is the co-moving entropy density? So first of all, you see that it's constant. Again, you know, you have this dynamical geometry, but the co-moving entropy density is constant. And not only it's constant, but it's exactly what you expect. So in other words, when you do these coordinate transformations, so you have appropriate transformations of your primary operators. Some of them, if it's not primary, will pick some anomaly. But the co-moving entropy density is covariantly constant. It doesn't mean, so here I talk about particular states, which are equilibrium states, but you can study dynamical states in Minkowski in a CFT, and then there will be entropy production until you reach the equilibrium. And so you can actually show that the entropy production in Minkowski is going to be exactly the same as the entropy production in d-theta expansion if you use the conformal time. Again, just silly bulk change of variables.
Question?
Yeah.
Did I miss it? But did you assume that the Hubble rate was much bigger than the masses in the non-conformal theory that you're looking at?
There is no masses. Everything I spoke before was conformal theory. I'm going to go to non-conformal theory right now. And so let me do this. So now this is a simple non-conformal model. So here there is a part that's Einstein-Hilbert term, negative cosmological constant. And I add a scalar field. So the scalar field is dual to an operator of dimension 2. So now what I'm going to do, I'm going to turn on the mass scale. I'm going to call this mass scale lambda for the scalar field. And I'm just going to repeat exactly the same computation as I told you for the conformal field theory. The issue is I cannot do it analytically. I can do it analytically in the limit I was just asked. So when the mass is much, much smaller than the Hubble scale, you can do this computation analytically and perturbatively. So I have done this like 5 or 6 years ago, and Costa Skenderis reproduced it a couple, like last year maybe, exactly the same formulas. So there is some regime in which you can do it analytically, but if you are interested in general ratio, lambda over h, you have to do numerics. And so let me show you the numerics. So when you do that, you have this apparent horizon, and you find out that, yes, so there is this entropy density, it's not zero. And so it vanishes exactly when you turn off the mass, so you go back to conformal limit. And what you see here is this red curve, and that's a perturbative approximation. So I just showed you example. So this is a simple holographic model that results in a dynamical fixed point. Now, the way I associate the entropy production, I associate the entropy production with this apparent horizon, and you can actually derive a theorem from the PDEs that if you do that, then your entropy will always grow. Okay, so this is a consequence just playing around with PDEs and showing that, you know, it's always positive. So this is something that we did with Rob many years ago when we studied quenches, and so the same thing happens there. Good. So let me say something. So what I'm not going to talk about is the idea of phase transitions between different dynamical fixed points. So when I have a system, I ask the system, which is the preferred state, right, of this, if there are several different phases of the system. So I have to specify the ensemble, whether I am working in a canonical ensemble or microcanonical ensemble. Microcanonical ensemble is appropriate when I study dynamical questions. And so from the perspective of the microcanonical ensemble, if I fixed the energy density, then the real phase is the one that has higher entropy. And so here, you can show that it's exactly the same thing. So if my system have several dynamical fixed points, the one that has larger physical vacuum entropy, that one will be the attractor of late time dynamics. You can see this explicitly in the in the simulations, and this has been done. Where you can see this, well, you can take some of the holographics model where there is confinement, deconfinement, chiral symmetry breaking, and so there are several phases that characterized by some symmetry broken or not being broken. And so that leads to a different dynamical fixed points. And you can study phase transitions between them, you can study stability and all of that. Pretty much the whole idea of thermal equilibrium is extended here. Now, so this is a result of the simulation, right? So I initialized my system, I let it evolve. And so this red line tells me that eventually I expect my expectation value, an expectation value of this dimension two operator, to approach this red line, and you see that that's exactly the same thing. So this is what you see happening in the holographic studies when your system thermalizes. So if there are some expectation values, they take thermal values, and here it's exactly the same. I was telling you that dynamical fixed points might have, besides stress energy tensor, expectation values of some operators, and you see explicitly this approach to dynamical fixed point. Now, if you have good eyesight, you can see that this black line goes a little bit up, a little bit down, and so on. And that's exactly what happens with the quasi-normal modes in approach towards equilibrium, right? So, or from the black hole ringing. So if you have a black hole and you throw up something into a black hole, your black hole responds. And in a regime when your black hole is close to the equilibrium, which is the equilibria of black holes correspond to thermal equilibria in the holographic language, the approach is by the quasi-normal modes. So it's exactly the same thing happens here. So there is the spectrum of fluctuations that tells you how fast you are approaching this dynamical fixed point. I'm not going to talk more, but you know, you can compute them in various models. So now let me show you how would you characterize it in thermal equilibrium. And I'm saying that exactly the same thing can be done for these dynamical fixed points. So here I'm focusing on the expectation value of some operator. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to say that, well, at late times, it has to take the expectation value of this dynamical fixed point. And then I'm going to fit the time dependence with the set of lowest quasi-normal modes. And so if I'm going to use a single quasi-normal mode, it's a whole separate talk of what's the, you know, kind of the quasi-normal modes of this dynamical fixed point. I don't have time to go into details. But if I use only one quasi-normal mode in this fit, so I'm fitting the amplitude and the phase because the frequency I can compute. And then you can see that it's this blue line, right? So which tells you that you describe late time dynamics at the fractional level of 10 to the minus 7. So with only single quasi-normal modes, you are already very good capturing the late time dynamics. And you expect that if you add more quasi-normal modes, you make things better and better. And so if I have two quasi-normal modes, then you see this red line. And so now what I have done, I've blown this red line. And so you see that your approximation is a factor of 100 better. And now if you use three lowest quasi-normal modes in trying to approximate late time dynamics, then you're going to get this green line. Okay? So that's pretty much, and this is also well known that when you have black hole ringing, you need just very few quasi-normal modes to describe the dynamics. So that's it as far as theory concerns. And so now I'm going to talk, what did it lead to? What specific applications it can have? And so I'm going to show you that it has a very cute prediction and very cute things regarding the theory of gravitational reheating. So this is what Andre Linde, he wrote me, and he showed me the old literature, which, of course, I didn't know. But if you wish, this is what some of you might know as a theory of non-oscillatory reheating. And so basically, that's an implementation of this in a holography. So let me explain to you what's going on. So basically, the problem of hot Big Bang was that everybody thought that once you exit the de Sitter phase, then the physical entropy density will be zero. Okay, so you exit in an empty state. And because you exit in an empty state, you need to reheat, right? So the hot Big Bang has a, you know, thermal entropy. Okay, so how do you get this entropy? And so what people were usually saying, well, let's introduce the inflaton. Well, we have inflaton to drive the inflation, and so this inflaton will oscillate. It will couple to your degrees of freedom. It will reheat your gauge theory. Now, if you exit from a dynamical fixed point, you don't need that. The reason is that you already have the entanglement entropy, the non-zero finite entropy of the vacuum. So I'm saying that that's going to be, you can harvest it as you exit the inflation, and it is that entropy density that will become your entropy density of hot Big Bang. So let me show you some details. So remember this formula which was telling you that the entropy always grow. And so here, everything, you know, in principle, when I do simulation, nothing tells me that I have to be in de Sitter spacetime. And so what I can do now, I can actually study the exit from inflation. So that's the studies that have been done, that have been done numerically, but a lot of things can be extracted analytically as well. So I give you a very specific profile for the exit from inflation. It doesn't really matter. You can play with other functions. And so basically, as you go to time minus infinity, what you see is that you have this theta, okay? And then if you go to time plus infinity, you see that this Hubble parameter is zero. So you exited the inflation. And so what you can do, you can initialize your gauge theory somewhere here. And you can wait long enough. As you wait long enough, all the information about initial state of the system will get washed out. And so you end up in your dynamical fixed point. And then there will be what I call initiate exit from inflation, and then I call it terminate exit from inflation. Those are basically some random things where this kind of there is a variation of the Hubble parameters. You will see in a second that doesn't really matter. And now once you exit from inflation, what will happen is that you typically exit as a non-equilibrium state, and you need to evolve the system further until it thermalizes. Yeah.
You're not saying you have an inflation.
It has not. I'm saying that I have. I can show. I'm showing you that you can get a reheating in a different way. How you thought you could get.
The inflation is working the same way you have a potential.
I don't care about the inflation. See, the, from this perspective, the, what the inflation provides me is just the scale factor.
Right, but I don't care about inflation. How do you get inflation?
Well, there has to be, right, so that's not, from my perspective, I have a quantum field theory in a background space-time, and whatever the physics provided that background space-time doesn't matter to this analysis. I don't need, you know, I'm just saying that whatever it is, you get, you know, you can have some different profile, that's what your inflationary model is. The only thing that I'm saying is that your inflaton field does not couple to my degrees of freedom. Okay, so I'm focusing on this quantum field theory. Normally, you would have expected that either there is a gravitational reheating, how efficient it is. I will show here that the gravitational reheating is incredibly efficient. Very, very efficient. You can reheat to very, very high temperature. But in order to solve this problem, for example, Lev Kaufman and company, what they were doing, they were using parametric resonances and all of these things. I'm saying you don't need that. So that's what I'm explaining how you're going to get away from this. For the purpose of reheating, I don't care what drives the inflation. It's just a background space-time in which my theory lives. The thing is that my gauge theory couples only to gravity. It doesn't couple to inflationary physics. Okay, inflationary physics couples to gravity as well. It drives the inflation, but there is no direct coupling. Okay.
What's at the center of reheating?
You will see. Yeah, you will see this. So there is a specific thing, and that's why I was saying that there is a very efficient way. Okay, I know I started 5 minutes late.
You're fine. Okay.
Yeah, I'm almost done. It's not like Bruno who was defending and had 168 transparencies for his PhD defense. Okay, good. So let's suppose that I am going to exit the inflation very, very fast. Okay, so this is almost like a step function. So let's just estimate how much the scale factor changes. Right, so I just have to integrate the Hubble parameter from what I call the initiate exit and terminate exit, and you get something. And so you can see this gamma, it tells you the larger value of gamma tells you that it's very steep. And so you can see that when it is a step function, the universe doesn't have time to expand. So basically, if you have fast exit from the sitter, then the terminal scale factor is almost exactly the same as initial scale factor. So now recall what I was telling you, that in all these holographic models, their co-moving entropy can only be produced. It's a theorem. You prove it from the dynamics and evolution. And so from this thing, you know that the co-moving entropy density must increase. And so you know that at late times, it has to be at least as big as it is initially. And so what this tells you that the entropy density after you exit from inflation has to be the entropy density as you had before you start the exit times some ratio of the scale factors. But you know that this, so if you exit fast, then this thing is one, and you start exiting from inflation when your entropy was the entropy of this dynamical fixed point. So now you can see that this thing works only if you have non-conformal field theory. Because in a conformal field theory, this thing is zero. So then you have to go back to the original models of reheating. But I'm saying that now it's not the case. This thing is not zero. And so you know that this is your entropy density of the state as you exit here, and then it will thermalize, and as it thermalizes, it can only grow. So you sort of get a smaller bound on what your thermal entropy density will be. It will be at least as big as the entropy density of this dynamical fixed point. Now, those are words, but it's good when the words are confirmed by numerics, and that's exactly what happens. So in this model that I'm talking about, what I'm plotting you the co-moving entropy density. And remember, the co-moving entropy density is only increasing. It cannot decrease. And so you can see that as I go to a faster and faster exit, so this is like almost instantaneous exit from inflation, the co-moving entropy density does not change. Now, what happens with the physical entropy density is something different. So you see, if you exit very fast, there is not a huge difference between co-moving and physical entropy density because scale factor is of order one and doesn't change rapidly at the exit. But if you exit slow, then the universe expands a lot. And so it's actually beneficial in these models for you to exit as fast as possible, because you're going to lose this entropy that you want to harvest. You're going to lose this dynamical fixed point entropy because you're going to expand during the exit from inflation. And those plots are showing you that that's exactly what happens. So now, I exited from inflation, and then I can evolve my code further, and I can ask it thermalizes, okay? And so you do the simulations, and so you can see these are different models. So there are a bunch of scales. There is a Hubble parameter of the initial dynamical fixed point. There is a mass scale of your theory, and then there is this another mass parameter that tells you how fast you exit from inflation. And so you reproduce whatever the reheating temperature is, you basically compute it, and you can get some analytic curve. I don't have time to explain to you the regime you get. And in fact, it turns out that in the limit, when your Hubble parameter of the dynamical fixed points is much larger than mass, you can actually do the computations analytically. Okay, and that's given by this fit, the dashed line. And that, I claim, is the most interesting regime. So why did I say that the reheating is incredibly efficient? You look at this, and I'm saying this is where the reheating is the best. And you look at this and you say, well, your reheating temperature is, by the way, when I call maximum reheating temperature, it's reheating temperature for the fastest exit from inflation. That's what's the most beneficial exit to harvest this entropy. So why that is the case? I need to take the black to go to the black. But... Right, so I have this analytical result, but notice what I am plotting. I am plotting the reheat temperature. Still not, okay. I'm plotting the reheat temperature with respect to the Hubble scale. But that's not the right thing to plot, right? So I'm saying that in this particular model, it behaves like lambda over h to the 2/3 in the limit when your Hubble parameter is much larger than lambda. But that's not the right thing to do. Because once you exit from inflation, you forgot completely what's your Hubble parameter. And so instead, what you need to compare what's your reheating temperature to the mass scale of the theory. Okay, so imagine that you would have a theory with confinement. What you want to do, you want to reheat it above the deconfinement scale. And so this is not the relevant thing, but this is, okay? And now let's do some algebra. So what is this? This is TR over H times H over lambda. And so I just have to plug this in. So I have lambda over H to the 2/3 times H over lambda. And so this is H over lambda to the power 1/3. And so that's much larger than 1. And so what you see that if you start with a dynamical fixed point, which is natural what we expect in a, kind of particle physics, our inflationary early cosmology inflationary scale is much, much larger than any scale in the theory. I am saying that after you exit, you're going to get a huge reheat temperature, way, way above whatever confinement or deconfinement scale is. And this actually computations that, as you can see, can be done analytically. So there will be an upcoming paper soon where you can do this analysis in arbitrary D in conformal theories broken by different dimension operators. And you have a prediction what's going to be your maximal reheat temperature. Okay? That's just a simple application that can be done. Okay, so I'm done. So what I have done, I explained to you the new concept of what I call these dynamical fixed points. So the interesting thing is that this idea of the physical entropy density. So some people suggested to me that when you have de sitter, you have particle production. So in some sense, you can think of that there is this constant particle production, and I'm trying to describe, come up with an effective theory of these pair-produced particles. We can discuss this if you are interested. I don't think that's a very good thing to think about. It doesn't give the right numbers. It's not, the physics appears the same, tantalizingly the same, but maybe there is, and it's just a strong coupling reflection of that, but it's not, I don't know. So what I said is that, so the specific application is that this entropy of this dynamical fixed point can be harvested, and it leads to some very specific predictions. What's going to be your reheat temperature? So this already has been done. So in a variety of models, I have computed the reheat temperature. You get a very efficient reheating, and this 1/3 is replaced with some fractional power depending on delta and D. So what matters is that if you have theory which is non-conformal with different operators, you get the best reheating if your operator is almost marginal. It cannot be marginal, because if all your operators are marginal, then you have a conformal theory and you don't get any reheating at all from this perspective. So you don't wanna, so for example, those of you who know Klebanov-Strassler theory, so you compute and you will find there that it's something like 11 over 12 H over lambda, something like this. So the maximal reheating temperature. So this is very, very big. So it's here the power with H is 1/3, and here it goes as power 1. That's pretty much the largest power you get. So as I said, so this is the picture that you see from holography, but unfortunately, or maybe good, there is a way to try to understand it from pure field theory perspective. All right, so thank you.
Questions
for
Alex. Do you have anything to say?
No, I haven't thought about this, but that's an interesting. So in some sense, I might have said something, because what I was telling is that when you talk about thermal states, so approach towards thermal equilibrium is characterized by sound and shear modes. Those are the gapless modes from the hydrodynamic picture, but there are also gapped modes. So those are, the jargon that people use in holography are called quasi-normal modes. So here there are no analog of these hydro modes. There are no analog of the gapless modes. You only have gapped mode. So you compute the spectrum of gapped modes. It has been done. I actually did this computation at k equals 0. So this is kind of what you're asking. I have these dynamical fixed points. I want to know what is the spectrum of fluctuations. But Kostas Kenderis extended it to finite spatial momentum. It's going to be pretty much the same. It's not at late times, because momentum is going to be killed anyway. If because the space is expanding, so the momentum gets redshifted. And so that's going to be roughly your fluctuation. When I talk about phase transition, I mentioned that there are phase transitions. So the signature of phase transition is that you have some quasi-normal modes with the positive imaginary part of the frequency that signals to you instability. And that's typically associated with some spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the, in some models, this happens as well. So you compute this and you see that, you know, there is an instability, and then you can do numerics and you see, you know, all of this as well numerically.
Yeah. Can you comment on, like, you want me to go to the conformal point, but not quite there? It seems contradictory.
Yeah. So what happens is, right, so did I have it? Okay. It's almost like Rob once, I knew what Rob is gonna ask. So this is part of the paper that will, how do I make it big? Oh, okay. I'll just look. That, I just did it, I was a little bit lazy to type it in. Let me show you what you're asking. Okay. And I even highlighted it. No, I didn't. Okay, so you see this formula? So this is the formula that I was talking about. So when you approach, you know, this is like this ratio. The model that we discussed here was D equals 3 and delta equals 2. This goes in general. And so there is some pre-factor of this thing. And you can plot this. I mean, this is some horrible set of gamma functions that you can compute. I show there was somewhere. Yeah, some bunch of gamma functions. Just you can compute it analytically here because you are in a regime exactly near this small conformal breaking, you know, close to conformal theory. That's why you are able to do it analytically. Okay, so I'm showing you this plot. And so this plot, how does this prefactor depends on D and delta. So I did it for D equals 3. Sorry, D equals 3, that's 4 dimensions, 3 spatial dimensions. And so I looked at the operators from Brighton law on a Friedman bound to a marginal operator. So you see that it's 0. And here you expect it to be 0, because in that case, it's just marginal operator in the CFT. So you don't want any, you don't have any reheating. Here, it's kind of a singular limit, Brighton law on a Friedman bound. You have to analyze it carefully. It's not 0, so you get some different formula when you are exactly at Brighton law on a Friedman bound. And you get, you know, sort of the, this coefficient is the largest, but it's not the right way to think in terms of just this prefactor only. Because it, you get a different scaling with h over lambda. So you are very efficient over here. So the prefactor is small, but you basically get h over lambda, the largest ratio. Okay? So the cascading gauge theory, it's like very beautiful example. Because there you don't have any relevant operators. And you only have marginal operators, but are not exactly marginal. And so you would have gotten 0 for the reheat temperature, but here you are not getting 0. You get a reheat temperature pretty much, and this is valid in the limit when H is much larger than lambda. And so the fact that it's marginal, but not exactly marginal, you get this suppression by this. You can see here again, so if you take the theory conformal, you take lambda goes to 0, this goes to 0, right? So sort of whatever the stupid consistency checks you do, it works out.
Any questions? If not, let's check.